America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, a great day when important things are happening. Yes, it is an important development that President Trump will apparently declare his candidacy for a third run for the presidency. That will be tonight, a speech from Mar-a-Lago at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We will be on top of that. Also, the Russian media, at least, Russian state media, had RIA Novosti, the state news agency, has reported that that wasn't Russian missiles that killed two people and destroyed a grain processing plant in Poland attacking a NATO member. No, the Russian media say it was a Ukrainian missile. It was a Ukrainian S-300 surface-to-air missile system functioning abnormally. This is going to be a very serious thing when the world wakes up. I mean, when I say the world wakes up, President Biden, it's about 5 in the morning in Bali time, which is where he is. And we will see. This is a very crucial item because of Article 5 of the NATO Charter, which means that the attack on the territory of one member state is considered to be an attack on all. Speaking of attacks and repulsing attacks, Alan Dershowitz is kind enough to call us from Israel, where he is visiting. And on November 8th, there was a wonderful development to me, because I had always believed that some of the attacks on Alan, which many, many people heard about and know about, where he was attacked by one of the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. And no one is questioning that she was a victim of Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew and others. But she had accused Alan Dershowitz. She has now dropped her charges, saying that she may have made a mistake. And Alan, as I understand it, you're not going out after her for damages or anything of that nature. You're just expressing gratification and obviously thankfulness that this entire thing has been cleared up.
Well, she's the one who sued me for defamation. She dropped her lawsuit and admitted she may have made a mistake. I then obviously dropped my countersuit. But no, the case is not over yet, because there are secret recordings, both tape and video. There are depositions and there are emails that she has insisted must be kept confidential. I have insisted from day one that everything should be released, that I waive any right to privacy. I have nothing to hide. I've never had any sexual contact with anybody but my wife during the relevant time period. I've never done anything wrong sexually in my life. So I want everything to come out. She has much to hide. And until the public gets to see her actual statements and listen to her voice and listen to the voice of her best friends, the whole truth won't come out. And that's what I'm looking for. So right now the accusation against me has been dropped, and I'm gratified and I wish her well, but I want the public to see everything. There's no reason for any of this to be kept secret.
And I won't ask you what could more come out. I mean, when you talk about the all of the revelations we've had about Jeffrey Epstein, I mean, that's enough. do you think that this case is going to continue to so much of the public's attention, or is it tampering down now with a new king in Britain and Prince Andrew suffering consequences? But is this going to continue to be a public obsession?
I don't know. I mean, remember, she accused not only me, she accused Ehud Barak, former prime minister of Israel, George Mitchell, the former majority leader of the Senate, Bill Richardson, the former ambassador to the UN, Jacques Cousteau's great-granddaughter, and others. And, you know, she claimed to have had sex multiple times, unprotected sex, with all of these distinguished people, every one of whom denied it. And I would hope maybe that the end of my case would encourage others to come forward and issue some challenges. But my case is over. But the whole situation is still up in the air. Prince Andrew, according to newspaper reports, has felt emboldened by her admission about me. But I don't know whether it's going to be over or not. It's over as far as I'm concerned, except for wanting to open up all the documents and materials. You always have to ask the question, if there's a credibility issue between two people, and one of them says, I want everything turned out, I want everything disclosed, I don't have any secrets, and the other says, no, 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 everything should be kept secret, nothing should be disclosed, you wonder what that says about who's telling the truth, right?
Yes, you do. Speaking about that, I think certainly right now there's a question about, were they Russian missiles that struck Poland?
Yeah.
And right now, World War III is trending on social media because of Article 5 of the NATO Charter. Do you have any immediate thoughts on the reliability of the information from Russian state media?
Well, you cannot ever rely on information from Russian state media. But it's very likely that if they were Russian missiles, it was accidental. It was close to the Ukrainian Polish border. It's inconceivable to me that Russia would have made a deliberate decision. They may have made a reckless decision to fire rockets close to the Polish border, but I can't imagine that they actually targeted Poland knowing about the obligation of NATO nations to regard it as an attack on them. So I would have thought Russia would have been smarter not to deny it, unless it's true and unless they have overwhelming evidence of it. But if it was Russian missiles, they should have said, which probably is the case, that it was an accident and it won't happen again.
Yes, exactly. Particularly if they're willing to pay some kind of compensation to the people who died and the facilities
the grain,
that were destroyed.
That
something like that could actually maybe be a first step toward ending the war. Speaking about ending the war, I know you're not the world's biggest fan of the incoming Prime Minister of Israel. A general quick comment, reaction to the new government that is now being assembled by Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yeah. I mean, Bibi is a good friend of mine. I've known him since he's 22 years old. We met in 1970 when we were both on a show called The Advocates. He was a student at the time at MIT, and in fact, he called himself Ben Natai instead of Benjamin Netanyahu. And we've been close friends ever since. I am a fan of his. I am not a fan of some of the other people that he may be bringing into his government, people like Ben-Gavir, who seems to be homophobic and racist. And I hope that Bibi can figure out a way of creating a government, over time at least, that doesn't include people who he doesn't agree with. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu himself is very pro-gay rights and women's rights. And, you know, he is a moderate centrist himself, personally. But in order to form a coalition at the moment, because the left won't join in a national unity coalition, he has to be opening himself up to people like Ben-Gavir. And that, I think, is too bad. And I certainly am not a fan of that.
The one good thing is that this is a government that should last longer. It seems to have at least the prospect of durability, so they won't have to go through an election every few months again after having had five elections in the last 4 years. Alan Dershowitz, congratulations to you. I'm very gratified, and I think all people who have benefited from your wisdom and patriotism over the years are extremely pleased to see the developments in the Dershowitz case. We will be right back with the case between war and peace and running for president and maybe delaying it, coming up on the MedVet Show.
Michael
Medved.
He has control over this world.
This is the Michael Medved Show.
And Russia seeks control over the world, or Vladimir Putin does. And Russian state media are reporting that it was, in fact, Ukrainian, not Russian missiles that hit Polish territory, provoking new expectations of a potential World War III in Europe. These allegations are unsubstantiated. I mean, highly unsubstantiated and questioned by everybody who isn't on the Putin payroll. A state news agency, RIA Novosti, quoted a Russian military expert, that's in quotes, who claimed that Russian cruise missiles would not have been able to reach Polish territory, but Ukrainian S-300 surface-to-air missiles functioning abnormally could. Several pro-Kremlin Telegram channels published similar claims. General Barry McCaffrey, who's been a frequent guest on this show, basically suggested, he wrote what would be a powerful script for Vladimir Putin or for Peskov or for Medvedev, for any of the spokespeople for the Kremlin right now, would be to acknowledge, say, look, the world knows that our missiles are imperfect, and that is certainly something that the world knows. This was unintentional. We will pay some compensation for the limited damage that was done with two missiles. And meanwhile, we do not seek to threaten in any sense the territorial integrity of Poland or other states in the vicinity. And something like that could be a constructive step toward peace. There's a powerful piece, by the way, today by Boris Johnson. Remember him? About the only chance for peace is Ukrainian victory. And I think that most people looking at this would agree with that. Meanwhile, there is that big, big speech tonight. And I'm sure that President Trump is going to be working very hard on it. This is a historic moment. It clearly is an unprecedented sort of development, because when you talk about the only previous time that a president came back after losing an election and then ran and got back in the White House was with Grover Cleveland, and that was at a time in which there were no, how do you put it, insoluble issues or unbridgeable issues between Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison, who ran against him twice. And that was a very, very different election. It was 1892, so it's a long time ago, when Cleveland came back. And Joe Scarborough raised the point, former congressman, Republican congressman, now on MSNBC, and not much of a conservative voice at the moment, but somebody who talks, I think, sympathetically sometimes about Republican dilemma. And he said this, clip 8 this morning.
Republicans lost local races and state races in 2017. They got hammered in 2018 in the midterms. They lost southern governorships and other races in 2019. And, you know, in places like Louisiana and Kentucky, they lost the House, the Senate, the White House in 2020. They lost again in 2022. Fairly historic. I'm wondering, do the Republicans wake up at this point? And what's it mean for this country if they do, if we are seeing the end of the Trump era?
The end of the Trump era, or a beginning of a new Trump era? There is a powerful piece by Rui Teixeira of the American Enterprise Institute, who says, Democrats, truth be told, Democrats are now in a weird codependent relationship with Mr. Trump. They know, and they are correct in thinking this, that the craziness associated with him is their most effective point of attack against the Republican Party and its candidates. Mr. Trump, of course, loves being the center of controversy. Meanwhile, the weaknesses remain. In a pre-election poll conducted by Impact Research for Third Way, respondents preferred Republicans over Democrats by 18 points on the economy and inflation, and by 20 points or more on crime and immigration. The poll also found that slightly more voters regarded the Democratic Party as too extreme, 55%, than felt that way about the Republican Party, 54%. Mr. Biden, cheered on by the left, has already announced that he will do nothing differently. This puts them in an exceptionally poor position to address the DeSantis problem. What if 2024 arrives and they no longer have Donald Trump to kick around? To compound the problem, Democrats are staring down the barrel of an unfavorable Senate map in 2024. And this, by the way, is very important and very important to talk about, because 2024 should be the year that the Republicans win a durable, enduring majority in the Senate. Why? Because there will be 33 seats that are in play in 2024. And of those 33 seats, 23 of them are held by Democrats. So only 11 held by Republicans. Holding those Democratic seats will mean winning in a raft of red and purple states. Arizona, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin, and West Virginia. The Republican seats that are up are all in solid GOP states, with the possible exceptions of Texas and Florida. And we saw what just happened there. And Rui Teixeira says this. He says, imagine a DeSantis ticket accompanied by saner, more competent Senate candidates. Are the Democrats prepared for that? I think not. But instead of addressing the problem or even admitting it exists, they're counting on Mr. Trump to bail them out. This seems exceptionally foolish. It is also morally reprehensible. They're trading a better chance of winning for the possibility that Mr. Trump might become president again. Look, in terms of the Democrats and their future, it's perfectly appropriate to recognize that Republicans won just about as often as they lost on Tuesday, and that Republicans are taking over the House of Representatives of the United States. By the way, the behind-closed-doors meeting today of Republican members of the House showed that they are going to unite, at least to a great extent, behind Kevin McCarthy. He does not have a serious challenger for the speakership. But with all of that going on, there's something else worth talking about, especially given the dangers of an enhanced confrontation and maybe even warfare in Europe. It's a book and movie about an unsung but very worthy hero in American military history. Coming up. And on the Michael Medved Show, it is a pleasure to welcome to the show a writer and a very fine writer, New York Times bestselling author named Adam Makos, whose book Devotion is a true story of America and American heroism and America's efforts to overcome racism and more about America's forgotten war, the Korean War. And it's based on a book by Adam Makos, who also worked on the movie. I've seen the movie. We're going to be reviewing it right before Thanksgiving when it comes out. And but I will tell you in advance, I can think it's one of the finest movies of the year. And Adam, when you were working on this film, were you already aware of the great success of the Maverick movie, the Top Gun movie, which had made so many literally billions of dollars, a very, very successful film. Was that project in mind when you helped to create this project of heroic naval aviators?
Michael, you know, it was at first kind of a threat. We were so afraid that that was going to come out and just steal all the thunder, and ours would look like some sort of copycat piece. But it turned out that Top Gun Maverick showed people that aviation can be this incredible thrill ride. In a lot of ways, it set the deck for Devotion. So when we were starting Devotion back in 2017, we hadn't even heard whispers of Top Gun Maverick. So it wasn't really a thought at the time. But it's amazing that the hero of our movie, the hero actor, Glenn Powell, ended up playing in both films.
Yeah, and by the way, the performances by Glenn Powell and by Jonathan Majors playing wingmen who, one black, a sharecropper's son, Jesse Brown, and the other from the New England upper crust, Tom Hudner. Partially, this is a story of that unlikely friendship, but what's amazing to me is the scenes of aerial combat. Now, you're interested in this. You write history. You've covered past wars before. But frankly, I didn't really know about some of the difficulties they had just operating those Corsair airplanes.
Well, they were big, dangerous machines. The Corsair, they said, could flip a house with a torque from its engine. And it was difficult to land on a carrier. It had this long snout, and it just blocked any forward view. So when you're coming in to land, you can really only see out of the crack of the windscreen, and you're kind of looking at this guy who was called Paddles. He was the LSO, landing signal officer, and he's there waving these little flags, telling you if you're too high or too low and how to speed up or correct. And so it required a lot of blind faith to land these things. So it's a dangerous machine, and these were really young men flying these. Tom Hudner was 26. Jesse Brown was 24 years old. Really young looking back.
Yeah, and again, this is about the Korean War, and the use of these planes and staging these scenes of aerial combat. How many of the Corsairs did you get airworthy and actually use in the film?
They used four of these original Corsairs, each one built 1944, 1945. And they flew them up to Washington State. And the first time I saw them, they were painting them in a hangar. And when they put the war markings on them, the big white K's on the tail to symbolize the USS Leyte, I mean, it was just, it was coming to life. And it was, yeah, I had to pinch myself. They even were saying, okay, what color navy blue should we paint these things? Should it be a royal blue or should it be dark blue? And so we were getting the paint schemes right. And what you're going to see in this film, you're going to see so many real planes flying and doing incredible aerial stunts that a lot of people are going to actually think it's CGI. So in Washington State, there's this scene where Jesse Brown's Corsair is ripping down the river at 5 feet above the water. And somebody actually did that. And they had rescue divers on hand and a rescue boat there. I mean, this is really hair-raising stuff. And you're going to see it on the screen and you'll think, oh, it's a computer. I'd say 95% of the flying in the film is from real aircraft.
Well, it's amazing, and it gives you a sense of how excruciatingly difficult it is to land on a flight deck and some of the risks that you actually see in the movie, not to give anything away, that are involved even with getting a plane back on board.
It really was the most dangerous job in the world. And that's why the Navy pilots consider themselves to be the best in the world. And that's actually what bonded Jesse Brown and Tom Hudner. They were both quiet, soft-spoken guys, but they were quiet professionals. They wanted to be the best at their job. They wanted to be safe. They wanted to be smart. And that's how they found a kinship in each other. And it was a friendship that they would take to the ends of the world, as we see in the movie. I mean, they literally go to the ends of the earth for each other.
And Jesse Brown was the first black aviator in Navy history. And he had always wanted to fly, at least so it says in the film and in your book. His family actually had some role in the production, no?
His family was consulted very early on to be involved and to share their memories of him. The producers of the film wanted to make a real film about real guys, and they could have easily fictionalized this and saved themselves a lot of headaches and just, you know, there's no toes to step on if you make it all fake. They wanted to make this a serious movie about serious men, and Jesse Brown was just an incredible, stirring example of what America could produce. He won friends over wherever he went, even though he was walking into a situation that no other young black man had done at that point, you know, becoming a naval aviator. People around him saw that he wanted to fight for this country, wanted to fight for a country that wouldn't let him drink from the, you know, a water fountain, or would make him sit in the back of the bus. How could you not like a guy like that, who's still willing to fight for a country that really doesn't like him?
I was thinking, because there is a scene at the end of the movie, and again, no spoilers at all, but a scene involving President Truman, and with an actor who actually kind of looks like President Truman. And I was thinking, with that scene, the movie doesn't call attention to it. It was President Truman who ended the segregation of our armed forces, right?
It absolutely was. And the amazing thing is, I believe that was 1947 or 48 that he signed that declaration. But even by the Korean War, we're talking 1950, units were not integrating. So a lot of generals and officers still had this old belief of, we need to keep everybody separate. It was actually the disaster at the start of the Korean War that led to the real full-scale integration of the military. When the North Koreans came across the 38th parallel, they almost drove American forces into the sea. And so as we were fighting for that toehold in South Korea, black troops were rushed into battle, all black units. And when they were repulsing the North Korean, you know, attacks, the white soldiers next to them said, wait a second, you know, these guys are pretty good. And so really the integration of the U.S. military really began summer 1950 in the Korean War. That's when we really finally got our act together.
Which is exactly the time period. And part of what's great about the way that they've done the film, and I know it's based on your book, the book and film are both posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Book is called Devotion, so is the movie. What is great about it is, even if you don't know anything about Korean, even if you don't a Korean War, even if you don't know about the Chosin Reservoir, which was one of the most difficult chapters in the history of the Marine Corps, you'll find out about it and understand it and be thrilled and inspired by it when you go see this movie. I appreciate it, Adam Makos. Congratulations on your success, and with great hopes for success of the film. We'll be right back. Michael Medved show, it is fascinating to try to think of what is going to happen in terms of media coverage and the networks running President Trump's announcement live. I would think that they would want to, because a lot of people are interested in, not all people who just love President Trump, though there's a big chunk of Americans who do. But just because this is a newsworthy development, he would be an instant favorite to win the Republican nomination. And maybe the fact that he is running and he is announcing so early, with the hope of two things, and this is what everybody brings out, is that part of what Trump's thinking is about deciding to make the announcement tonight from Mar-a-Lago, if he goes forward with it, part of his thinking is, number one, to clear the field, to discourage people like Mike Pompeo or even Mike Pence or Governor Youngkin, or certainly Governor DeSantis, to discourage them from running because President Trump is going to be starting out with such a head start in terms of not commanding full loyalty from everyone in the Republican Party, but from a big chunk of the Republican Party, which nobody else really has. Maybe it's that is one of the reasons that Ted Cruz, in an episode of a podcast, reacted to the midterms and didn't sound like he was in a good mood. This is clip 10, Senator Cruz.
Well, Ben, let me start off by saying I am so pissed off I cannot even see straight. We had an extraordinary opportunity. We had a generational opportunity. This should have been a fundamental landslide election. We should have won the House and the Senate. We should have a 30, 40, 50 vote majority in the House. We should have 53, 54, 55 Republicans in the Senate.
That's true.
And instead, holy crap, the Democrats keep the Senate. Worse than that, the Democrats potentially grow their majority in the Senate. Worse than that, yes, we take the House, but at best, we're going to take the House with a couple of seats. Maybe. There is an outside chance we lose the House. I don't think we will. I think the numbers are enough that we will hold on to the House, but it's going to be a majority of 219, 220, 221, 222. 218 is a majority. So we're going to be looking at a 2-3-4 vote majority at best. The rage Americans are feeling across this country, the rage that I'm feeling, there are almost not words to describe it. Because this opportunity was screwed up. It was screwed up badly, and the people are going to pay the price, or the American people. The country is screwed for the next 4 years because of this. We're going to see horrible left-wing judges confirmed for the next 2 years because of this. We're going to see judges taking away our free speech rights, our religious liberty rights, our Second Amendment rights. It is an enormous missed opportunity, and I got to say it is hard to describe my feelings as anything other than rage right now.
Okay, who are you angry at, buddy? I mean, really, who is responsible for all of this? Now, I do think that there are a lot of people who are looking at this and looking at President Trump's role in picking people like Doug Mastriano, who I mean, he wasn't even in the same ballpark in Pennsylvania. He lost by a crushing margin. And it's because of him, the candidate for governor, that Mehmet Oz, somebody else who the president picked, where there were much better candidates available. The idea that Democrats should prevail now control the governorship in Arizona, because, see, this is another thing, and this is something to be ticked off about Ted Cruz. And what would be interesting is, I don't know if his interlocutor in his podcast came up with the next question. Okay, you're pissed, you're full of rage, you're so angry you can't find words. Who are you angry at? And again, there are a lot of people within the Republican Party who took the attitude of Marjorie Taylor Greene. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of the least welcome voices in public life, honest to God. But she had this to say about the Civil War, which she welcomes in the GOP. Clip 7.
We're going to fight it out. And I'm telling you, I've always said I'm not afraid of the Civil War in the GOP. I lean into it. You want to know why? I want to do everything I can to do my part within our conference to force the Republican Party to be the party that is America first and saves this country.
Okay, I'm not afraid of the Civil War in the GOP. You know why? Because you're in a district where basically the seat goes to you automatically. Now, there are even some seats like that, like Lauren Boebert's seat, where it was close, and it's not all clear that Congresswoman Boebert is going to be coming back. But how can you not be afraid of a GOP civil war? I mean, the latest today is that, honest to goodness, Rick Scott, who is the senator from Florida, the junior senator from Florida, former governor, he is apparently preparing to challenge Mitch McConnell to be leader of the Republicans of the Senate. It'll be minority leader, just as he has been, because the Senate is going to maintain at least that break the tie Kamala Harris majority, if not an actual majority. If Herschel Walker loses, if Raphael Warnock wins, the Democrats will have an actual majority of 51 votes. And to have Rick Scott, now Rick Scott was in charge of the Senate campaign this year, which was a disaster and should have been so easily winnable. And for instance, there are races like the race in Arizona, where if they had been able to persuade Doug Ducey, who was the outgoing governor, to run in Arizona, if they had been able to persuade Chris Sununu, decided to stay as governor in New Hampshire. He won the governorship by 15 points. And if he had run for Senate against Maggie Hassan, who barely eked out a Senate win against a guy who's pretty far out there, that's Don Bolduc, who originally had said his top priority would be to overturn the election of 2020, which he thought was fraudulent and was stolen. And then after he won the Republican nomination on that basis and he got Trump's endorsement, he said, no, it's not. I've looked into it. Election's on the level. I mean, with all of this, and you have Rick Scott, who basically had released his own tax plan, which included raising taxes on the poor so that everybody paid in. It wasn't enough that people do pay in for Social Security taxes and sales taxes. And I mean, Rick Scott was not a big hero in this election. Ron DeSantis was, and he finally responded to some of Trump's recent criticisms just ahead of the president's former president's announcement tonight. Here is what Governor DeSantis sounded like. Listen.
One of the things I've learned, in this job, is when you're leading, when you're getting things done, yeah, you take incoming fire. That's just the nature of it. I roll out of bed in the morning. I've got corporate media outlets that have a spasm just the fact that I'm getting up in the morning, and it's constantly attacking. And this is just what's happened. I don't think any governor got attacked more, particularly by corporate media, than me over my four-year term. And yet, I think what you learn is all that's just noise. And really what matters is, are you leading? Are you getting in front of issues? Are you delivering results for people? And are you standing up for folks? And if you do that, then none of that stuff matters. And that's what we've done. We focused on results and leadership. And at the end of the day, I would just tell people to go check out the scoreboard from last Tuesday night.
A pretty effective response, don't you think? What it calls to mind, and Governor DeSantis ought to use this, is that Winston Churchill picked up an old Arab saying, which is, the dogs bark, but the caravan moves on. And I love that, because it really does apply so much to politics and to life. More on that politics, on whether Trump is actually going to announce his candidacy tonight, whether he should, and how he should announce it if he does, in this greatest nation on God's green earth.